the benefits of being formal are very low in developing countries for small firms. You can make the cost of formalization as low as you want, and still firms choose not to formalize because the benefits are just not there.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. A huge proportion of economic activity takes place in the informal sector in low and middle-income countries. It affects the families who live in slums, the people who take off-the-books jobs, the firms that choose to skirt regulations, and also the governments who want to increase the size of the formal sector and increase the size of the revenue they can collect from it. Gabrielle Ulisea of UCL and Nina Harari of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania are two of the authors of a new Vox Devlet on the causes and consequences of informality. And they join me now. Gabrielle, hello.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much. Nina, welcome.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
First of all, we've got to find out how big this informal sector is. In terms of things like the number of people employed or the proportion of GDP or the amount of housing, how big is the informal sector?
Well, it's pretty massive across countries. It's also a wide range of sizes. In terms of the labor force, it goes something between 20% in the low informality countries, up to 80-90% of the labor force. In some sub-Saharan African countries, for example, or 30 to 70% of GDP. So it's pretty large, and it's equally large in other dimensions as well.
For housing, it's hard to get an accurate measurement, but according to UN estimates, about 1.1 billion people, which is roughly 25% of the world's urban population, live in informal settlements or slums.
If I am working in a job in the informal sector, how is that job different?
It's different in many ways, but I think the stark contrast is that you're at the margin of all regulations and laws that are relevant to govern a work and employment relationship. So you're not covered by unemployment insurance if it exists in your country. You're not covered by the minimum wage legislation. You're not covered by health in the workplace. You're not eligible for pensions when you retire. So like really at the margin of all of these dimensions. Of course, there's a gray area in between formality and informality because some firms comply with some of these dimensions, but not others. So it is essentially it's me at the margin of the laws and regulations.
And if I'm running a firm and that's in the informal sector, what does that mean I'm doing differently? Or I suppose, what does that mean I'm not doing?
So for firms, it's less binary than for workers because firms, there is a, what we call the extensive margin, which is like firms that are completely at the margin. So they are not registered with the tax authorities. So they don't exist from the government perspective, which means that they cannot open a dedicated bank account to their business because the business doesn't exist, formally speaking. They cannot issue an invoice to their buyers. That also limits whom they can transact with. But even when they're registered in that sense, so like that's what we call the informal and the extensive margin, they can still hire workers without a formal contract. And in that sense, they would be in the intensive margin of informality, hiring workers off the books. And of course, there's the more familiar dimensions of informality that we have also in richer developed economies, which is like tax evasion. You might simply be underreporting your revenues, and that's a type of informality, if you will, one that is much harder to measure than the ones that I referred to.
Now, in the introduction, I was talking about how governments really, really want to increase the size of the formal sector. That's how I understand it. Does the informal sector shrink as a function of development?
It does. This is one of the most well-known facts, let's say, about informality, is that it correlates negatively with GDP per capita, which is a common measure of development. So as you go from poorer to richer economies, typically the share of the informal economy in any dimension that you look at shrinks. But even within certain income levels, you see massive variation. So basically, level of development as measured by GDP per capita is by no means all there is to informality. So even if you go to higher income countries, you have variation from 20 to 70% of the labor force. And I think there are other dimensions that you can see similar things.
For housing informality, I would say it is less clear. There used to be this view of slums as a transitory phenomenon of growing economies. But really, we don't have very compelling evidence of how economic growth maps to reductions in slum growth. The experiences of different countries seem to be quite heterogeneous. And in general, it is very hard to measure informality in housing over time and across countries in a comparable way. But overall, we don't have very rigorous evidence of slums disappearing with economic growth.
Gabrielle, you mentioned that firms in the informal economy, they don't exist. It's kind of hard to count things that don't exist. So for both of you, is it hard to do your research because it's hard to measure what the size of this economy is?
It's definitely a big issue when you're analyzing the informal sector. We are lucky to have developing countries that have a long tradition of measuring firm informality or worker informality through surveys. And because they have this long tradition of collecting this information and disclose it to the government branches that are in charge of enforcing the laws and regulations, people feel confident in responding to these surveys. We have this good measurement of some dimensions of informality, not all, like the arguably the share of GDP that goes to the informal sector is much harder to get right than the share of firms or the share of workers. And I pass the ball now to Nina, because I think the challenges when it comes to housing are much greater.
Yes, indeed. Measuring housing informality is really tricky. One reason is that there isn't a clear-cut definition of what counts as a slum or informal housing. Is it about lack of property rights, poor infrastructure? These things vary a lot across places. Property rights and tenure security are central to many definitions, but they're very difficult to observe directly. On top of that, slum residents are often systematically underrepresented in official data sources because in many instances, they are not officially supposed to be living in those places. So when we try and measure housing informality at scale, as researchers, we have been increasingly relying on observable characteristics, which could be the narrow roads or the building heights, the building density, the tin roofs, captured through imagery, which could be satellite imagery or ground imagery. But this makes it quite difficult to get data that is comparable across different settings, and also monitoring changes over time is very tricky. And in general, we've made more progress measuring slum neighborhoods relative to tracking people in slums, which is still very, very difficult.
There is so much to cover in this, Fox Devlet. We will talk about some of the research after this break.
My name is Oliver Hanney. I'm the managing editor here at VoxDev, and I'm here to give our VoxDevlets a short plug. We now have 14 available on our website and the same amount currently underway. VoxDevlets from VoxDev are easy to read, policy-oriented literature reviews that will help you to stay informed. In each VoxDevlet, experts in their field distill the evidence on important questions in development economics.
What's interesting is that it is actually trying to do different things.
Every time we answer a question, it raises one or two more.
From agriculture to trade, from bureaucracy to mobile money, VoxDevlets are open access, accessibly written, policy-focused and regularly updated. Find them at voxdev.org/voxdevlit.
This is a really interesting set of questions. It opens up a whole can of worms.
And stay tuned for our upcoming release on electricity infrastructure and an update to our VoxDevlit on the informal sector.
Let's talk about workers first of all. Gabrielle, do workers stay informal if they're in the informal sector, or is this something that they tend to duck in and out of?
You can see both in the data. So there are some work, like a mass of workers that actually seem to be trapped in informality. You know, like they enter the informal sector and they might be in and out to non-employment, but back to the informal sector, but they don't use that necessarily as a stepping stone to get access to formal jobs. And you do see workers that are doing more transitions in and out of the formal sector into the informal sector and back. But at least the preliminary evidence that we have on that is not very positive in terms of the informal sector overall acting as a stepping stone. So it doesn't seem to be the case that, like, you know, this is an entry door for workers. They later, they can use that to get access to a formal job, except for perhaps migrants. It might be the case that, especially for rural migrants that go into cities, they might be absorbed at first in the informal sector, but then later they are absorbed to the formal sector, and the formal sector can actually expand as a result of migration, which is something that until recently it was unclear if that was the case.
And of course, a very important part of understanding what's going on with the process of migration and city formation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Generally speaking, when these workers are moving in and out of informality, is this a decision that they're making? How much agency do they have, or is it forced on them?
That will vary from which economist you ask that to. I typically think that it's a choice. I think the key question is, like, how hard do you make it for workers to actually get access to a formal job? Mm-hmm. How long do they have to wait? how many hurdles they have to overcome to get access to a formal job, how prevalent the formal jobs are in the economy such that it's actually costly or not to search for a formal job. But ultimately, it's a choice. You might be searching forever and trying to find a formal job, or you can take an informal job, which typically it's more easily available, it's more flexible, and so on and so forth. That said, there are trade-offs and there are costs and benefits to both choices. And that's important because on the one hand, formal jobs offer more security. They offer access to all the benefits that I already mentioned, like unemployment insurance, minimum wage coverage, social security. But also they are typically very rigid in most developing countries. Mm-hmm. Whereas informal jobs, they offer a lot more flexibility in terms of where to work. You can work from home. Like that's been a thing in the informal sector before. Working from home was a thing. That favors workers that actually don't want to commute long distances in developing country cities to get access to formal jobs. Women are overrepresented in informal jobs, partly because of the flexibility issue. Now I'm getting to why, you know, the social norms are what they are. But like women are overburdened with childcare responsibilities and household responsibilities in these countries. So if you have access to a more flexible job that you can do in flexible hours, working from home and commuting less time, that actually has a value as well. So like there's these trade-offs that make it more interesting than simply an exclusion story of informality.
What about wages? If you're working an informal job, you're not protected by any minimum wage legislation. You don't have very much power to negotiate with your boss. On the other hand, the firm is saving money because it's not paying taxes. Do the wages end up higher or lower?
So on average, lower. Uh-huh. If you look at workers of the same with exact same characteristics in the same firm, and you compare their wages, one is working with a formal contract and another one with an informal contract, on average, the wage difference is zero, gross wage, mm-hmm. which means that actually the net wage might be higher for the informal worker because they are not paying taxes. Now, there are the other benefits that it's very hard to put a monetary value to them, like this greater security, the benefits that they will receive later in life. Once you incorporate all of these things, and some papers are starting to do that, actually the formal job comes out as more desirable and more valuable to workers because of these different components that are valuable in the short and in the longer run.
And you find that younger people, generally speaking, tend to be more informal?
That's correct. So there's a very clear life cycle pattern of informality. It follows this U-shape, which is younger workers and older workers tend to be more informal, but it's different types of informality. The younger workers are more informal employees. So they are working for a firm, they have an employer, but they have informal contracts. And that's consistent with the fact that in these countries, like there's also many frictions that prevent employers from observing the workers' characteristics, especially at younger ages. So like they have less information about them. Informal contracts can be a way of reducing some of the costs of hiring these workers. As they get older, they accumulate more human capital, they are less likely to be informal. But then after a certain point, the informality starts increasing again, but then it's through self-employment, which again, whether this is a choice or not, it remains an open question because there are like life cycle components to the decision of being a self-employed because you accumulate human capital and many people actually report that they want to be a self-employed to be their own boss. And the benefits of being a formal self-employed in these countries are very low. So actually being an informal self-employed makes sense from an economic standpoint. And then informality starts increasing again because of this movement of older workers becoming self-employed.
I see. So it's not really correct to think about informality just in terms of the power imbalance between the employer and the employee, even though that's obviously a feature of it. There is also evidence of strategic behavior here, people doing things that best suit them at the moment in time.
Absolutely. And even at the aggregate level, the presence of informal jobs decreases the ability of firms in the formal sector that have market power in the formal sector to exert that market power over workers because workers have this outside option, which is informal jobs. In that sense, even at the aggregate level, the informal jobs can have this positive role.
Okay, so let's talk about firms. I can imagine that there are certain types of firms that couldn't possibly be informal. You can't have an informal Google. But further down the ladder, are informal firms, generally speaking, of a different type to formal firms?
Yes. And as you already alluded to, size is a strong predictor of whether firms is informal or not. So basically, you see a clear pattern of formalization as firms grow bigger. And the reason it's almost obvious, right? Like you're bigger, you're more visible to the government, so therefore you're more likely to be inspected. But not only that, it's like more stronger economic reasons as well for why bigger firms tend to be more productive, on average at least. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they would like to participate in government procurement. They would like to expand their customer base. They would like to have access to a dedicated bank account to their business, and they cannot do that if they're informal. So then the overall economic cost of being formal increases as firms become more productive and become bigger. So in that sense, the informality is also a sort of subsidy for smaller and lower productivity firms to operate in the economy. And that can have, on the aggregate, very distortive effects because it can shift resources from more productive, bigger, formal firms to less productive, smaller, informal firms.
And as you said, this is a gray area. We're slightly artificially talking about firms as being either formal or informal. Is there evidence that there are formal firms with informal workers, or firms that generally move between the parts of the economy, or formal firms that do business with informal firms?
We have less information about the latter because there's no paper trail to look at when you see formal transactions that involve informal firms. Evidence suggests that actually you have more predominantly formal production chains and predominantly informal production chains, especially when you have VAT systems in place, which the tax that you pay to a given supplier or the tax embedded in a given transaction generates credits to be claimed down the supply chain. So if everybody's formal, they can all claim these credits. If someone is informal, that kind of breaks down this relationship. If you want to be formal, there are benefits in being a fully formal chain, for example. In terms of workers, actually 40% of informal workers are in formal firms.
Right.
So it's almost half of the informal labor force.
Wow.
It's huge. So if you don't consider that, you're missing a big part of the story. And that's fundamental when you're thinking about policies, because policies targeted at informal firms will not get to these informal workers working for formal firms.
And also talking about policy, do we know what incentivizes the decision of informal firms to formalize? Is it that there is a benefit for them, or is it more the fear of punishment?
So the fear of punishment is a powerful tool. So the little evidence we have is that enforcement really works. It also can have all sorts of unintended negative consequences as well. Because if you increase enforcement and you don't improve the regulatory and institutional environment that these firms are facing, you're probably making the problem even worse, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Then, like, more interesting trade-offs kick in, but, like, you potentially can make things worse. In terms of the costs and benefits, overall, I would say that the benefits of being formal are very low in developing countries for small firms. You can make the cost of formalization as low as you want, and still firms choose not to formalize because the benefits are just not there. And you can see that even in studies where firms do formalize, it's not at all a transformative experience. They do not change their behaviors. They do not become more productive. So it's a disappointing big zero in almost all dimensions.
Nina, let's talk about informal housing. We've talked about how firms are often both formal and informal at the same time, and it's very hard to work out which is which. Is the distinction very obvious between formal and informal housing?
Not always. There is no consensus on a universal definition of what counts as informal housing. The UN has a framework that includes things like lack of tenure security, inadequate housing materials, overcrowding, and a lack of basic services. And according to their definition, you don't need to tick all the boxes. Missing even one can classify a household as living in a slum. But there are many contexts where it is unclear whether this is an appropriate definition. Do we want to consider all low-income neighborhoods in developing countries as slums? And also there are instances where there are neighborhoods that look completely formal on the outside, but the housing isn't legally recognized. The example would be unauthorized colonies in urban India. And lack of property rights is often considered a defining feature, but even that exists on a spectrum. And there's a range of land tenure arrangements that have been documented across different settings. Some residents are squatting on land that is either owned by the government or by private landowners. In other contexts, slum residents are tenants who pay rent to absentee landlords. And yet in other contexts, slum residents hold customary rights that are locally enforceable and tradable and operate in a land rights system that is parallel to the formal one. And in many cases, these dual land rights systems have their roots in colonial times of direct and indirect rule. So the line between formal and informal is probably less clear-cut than you'd think.
Can we think about it in terms of infrastructure, facilities? What sort of infrastructure might someone living in slum housing lack?
Informal settlements often lack the basic infrastructure that many of us would take for granted, like piped water, sewage, electricity, road access, but that varies a lot depending on the context. For example, Kibera in Nairobi, one of the most studied slums in the world, where the majority of households lack private water access, they lack sewer connections, they have shared toilets, streets are narrow and inaccessible to vehicles. But if you look at informal settlements in a middle-income country like the kampungs of Jakarta that I've studied along with my colleague Maisie Wong, the vast majority of households have metered electricity. Most of them have private water and private toilets, but very few live in a street that is accessible by a car. So the road infrastructure is quite bad. So there's a lot of variation across different contexts.
Yes, I remember talking to Maisie about this and the surprising nature of some informal housing. But can we say something about the impact on the families that live there? Because clearly people sometimes live in informal housing for many years, maybe for their entire lives.
We still have a lot to learn about the economic livelihoods of slum residents and the trajectories of families in slums. As I mentioned before, this is a population that is notoriously difficult to track and to survey. What we do know largely comes from studies of how slum residents respond to policy interventions like housing upgrades or tidling programs. One finding is that poor shelter conditions negatively affect quality of life and self-reported well-being. And we know that lack of access to basic services like clean water or sewage can reduce health and educational attainment and is particularly harmful for children. We know that when tenure security is weak, people are less likely to invest in their homes and neighborhoods. And in some contexts, they might even reduce their labor supply to stay at home to protect their property. And all of these negative impacts raise the concern that slums may act as poverty traps where residents are stuck in persistent poverty. One other consistent theme that we find across many studies is the importance of social networks in slum communities. These networks often function as informal safety nets, offering support in the form of childcare, emergency help, or informal lending. And we know that when these networks are disrupted, for example, because of relocations away from a slum, households tend to do really poorly. And we also know that residents in slums seem to place a really high value on proximity to jobs. Some slums are in parts of a city that are pretty close to employment opportunities. And that supports one competing views of slums that, while of course the living conditions are really difficult, if low-income residents cannot afford the formal housing sector, there is a potential role for slums to provide a gateway for accessing the economic opportunities in the city. Ultimately, we need more research to understand how mobile slum residents are and to what extent are they ultimately able to graduate out of poverty and out of slums. This is likely to vary a lot by context, potentially even within the same city, and is definitely a big open question about slums.
So when we're thinking about policy to deal with the informal economy, one thing that really comes across very strongly from this Vox Dev Lit is it's not always quite what you would expect, and policies don't always have the impact that maybe the policymakers wanted or expected. For example, when we're talking about government support transfers, is there good evidence that they encouraged the informal sector because people don't want to give up their benefits?
I would say in the first wave of studies, actually exactly tackling this question, the results were either mixed or slightly in favor of these, especially means-tested programs, to induce either non-employment or informality because of the incentives, exactly because they depend on the resources of the family to determine eligibility. More recent studies, and in particular, there's one very nice one looking at an expansion of Bolsa Família in Brazil, a conditional cash transfer program, that shows that actually it increases formal employment for women, not for men. For men, the effects are zero. For women, it's positive because exactly by relaxing the monetary constraints that these women face, and then they can afford, for example, childcare or some form of child services like to release their labor supply in the formal market. So that's one result that I actually find very convincing and very interesting. But also, sometimes these transfers represent a big shock to a local economy, like a small municipality where many recipients actually receive this transfer, and that can actually make the local economy more dynamic. That actually can generate in equilibrium, like a sort of an aggregate effect, an expansion of formal jobs. Even if at the individual level, this might be generating some incentives for informality, at the aggregate level, you can still have these positive effects. So I think that the broader, more recent picture is more favorable than it used to be, say, 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
Gabriel, also, we've talked a little bit about how the tax authorities would really like to have a larger formal economy. I note that there have been a range of policies tried for this. Does the role of tax incentives, are we finding that that works in encouraging firms to formalize?
Unfortunately, it works poorly. So the first big initiative in terms of trying to formalize informal firms was to reduce the registration cost, the fixed cost to enter the formal sector. The bureaucracy to get a taxpayer number and officially register your business, this was thought to be one of the main determinants. And then on average, what you get is a big zero.
Mm-hmm.
It might be necessary, but it's not sufficient to induce formalization. Some other waves of studies have looked at the effects of reducing the ongoing costs of formality. So reducing how much taxes you have to pay. And that has a positive effect, but what we call the elasticity of formalization, so like actually how much formalization you induce by reducing taxes, does not compensate the losses you have by reducing taxes on already paying firms. So overall, the revenue effects seem to be negative. That goes back to the issue that ultimately, because the benefits are so low, even if you reduce the costs by reducing tax costs, the effects on formalization are limited. The stronger effects seem to be a combination of reducing some of these obstacles to formalization hand in hand with increasing benefits, say by facilitating access to a dedicated bank account or starting a credit line in a formal bank. So these kind of things together actually generate more powered incentives to formalization.
Nina, cities are growing rapidly. Migration to cities, especially with the effects of climate change, forced displacement, it's happening very rapidly. Of course, when people arrive in cities, especially if they are displaced, then they're not going to have jobs, they're not going to be able to rent in the formal sector. Are there policies that can stop the rapid growth of informal housing in this context?
So most governments in developing countries will say that they want their cities to be slum-free. There is a range of policy approaches that have been implemented. Their relative success depends a lot on the context. One approach is titling, so providing residents with a formal title that gives them tenure security. And the idea is that then they will have an incentive to invest in the neighborhood, they can trade their title, they can pledge it as collateral. And titling has been successful in spurring private investments and boosting labor supply. But I would say it's quite tricky to do at scale because you need a good institutional system to support the land mapping, the land registration, you need courts that are able to address land disputes and so on. Another policy approach is to provide subsidized housing to slum residents in formal neighborhoods. And often because governments are resource constrained, the only place where they can build public housing is parts of the city where the land is cheap, which often means in the periphery, in areas that have low access to jobs. So with a lot of these relocation programs where residents are moved into public housing, while there are benefits to residents in the form of the improved housing and tenure security, these programs can end up being very disruptive when the residents are moved away from their original neighborhood, which leads to a disruption of these networks that they rely so much on. And then they're moved to areas where they often face worse job market prospects. So there have been examples of successful programs of this sort, but it's usually because the neighborhoods that the residents are moved to is one that ends up developing businesses and opportunities, or programs where the residents are relocated nearby. So the location really matters. Also, the scale of the slums problem is so large in many cities that it isn't likely that the government would eventually be able to rehouse everyone. Another policy approach is slum upgrading, which your listeners might have heard a prior podcast with my colleague Maisie Wong, where she talked about a paper we wrote about slum upgrading in Jakarta. So with slum upgrading, the governments provide basic public goods like paved roads or sewage in existing informal settlements. And this is considerably cheaper than building public housing and is less disruptive because the residents remain in their community. So you upgrade on site. And the hope is that the public investments will spur private investments, and they also deliver immediate improvements in the living conditions. The concern with slum upgrading is that you may end up with the upgraded slums persisting for longer than they otherwise would. And this can be a problem for slums that are located in very central areas that become really valuable as cities grow. And then that creates a trade-off between equity and efficiency. Improving and preserving slums in central areas can offer a lot of benefits to those residents who have access to jobs and economic opportunities, but it comes at the expense of not being able to raise formal land values by redeveloping these areas into formal neighborhoods with modern buildings and skyscrapers. And so overall, this suggests that slum upgrading is probably preferable in places where the formal land values aren't very high. Otherwise, it could be potentially costly from the standpoint of the city as a whole. And then finally, in contrast with these other approaches, sites and services has also been implemented. And this is kind of a forward-looking approach that targets areas that are not yet settled before people move in. And sites and services program create planned neighborhoods with regular spaced out plots and basic infrastructure like roads and pipes before residents move in. And this helps address some of the coordination failures that are associated with slums growing organically in an unplanned fashion. And this comes at a fraction of the cost of building the housing itself. And these programs have been shown to be successful in creating more orderly neighborhoods. But in some cases, they ended up benefiting middle-income households rather than the poorest because of plot sizes. The plots were too large and the costs were out of reach for the really low income. So the implementation details really matter with this sort of program. And more generally, this is a policy approach that is viable for cities that still have land availability, which is not the case for many cities.
There is so much more we could talk about. There's such a huge amount to know as well that we still have to find out in this area. I'd like you to imagine that you were restarting your successful careers again today. What research question would you want to pursue? Nina, you start.
We definitely need more research on upward and intergenerational mobility in and out of slums, understanding how human capital develops in these settings. What are the impacts on children being raised in slums? I also think we need more research to understand how the formal supply side works. There's a missing market for low-income formal housing, and it is also connected with market failures in credit markets and the lack of a housing finance system. So I think understanding the formal side is important to understand the informal side. There are also open questions related to the political economy of slums. In many settings, slums persist partly because of vested interests. And there's a sense that slums can operate as vote banks, but yet slum residents have rarely managed to mobilize to get better services. So I think that whole dimension is really underexplored. I think we want to be conscious that housing informality is intertwined with informality in all these other key markets, labor markets, transportation markets, credit markets. We need a better understanding of how low-income residents in developing country cities are making all these joint decisions, where to live, where to work, how to commute, facing market failures across all these different margins at the same time. And this is also why I think there isn't a silver bullet in terms of policies to address housing informality, because all these frictions are operating concurrently along all these different margins. And it is very difficult to address multiple failures at once.
Gabrielle, what would you choose?
It would be hard to add to Nina's list, but I actually think that the political economy component is vital also in all dimensions of informality, because we already have the tools, and we have had them for a while now, to enforce the laws and regulations we have in a more effective way to make the informal sector smaller. But the thing is that probably there's a very high social cost associated to that, because especially in the short run, because all of our models mostly refer to the long-run benefits of reducing informality. But the costs actually can kick in right away. And for a politician making decisions, for a policymaker, like they are influenced also by the political cycle, which is much shorter than perhaps the time horizon that would take for these benefits to kick in. So this tension and this political economy underlying policy choices, I think it's a fascinating debate in the political science literature. There has been some attempts to tackle that, but not in economics. And I think that's a fascinating question. And again, like this issue of dynamics, is informality a stepping stone for workers, for firms? To what extent do we have these benefits and costs kicking in at different moments in time in the life cycle of firms and in the life cycle of workers? I think we still have a lot to learn about that, which directly relates to the questions Anina is raising. These are not disjoint questions. These are the questions that make a lot of the development economics debate in these countries, I think.
I'd encourage everyone to read the Vox Dev Lit. You will see that we've only just scratched the surface. But for now, thank you very much, Nina.
Thank you.
And thank you, Gabriel.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
The Vox Dev Lit is called Informality, Causes and Consequences. You'll find all the Vox Dev Lits at voxdev.org/voxdevlit. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you'll also find articles about the topics we feature. And remember, if you like what you hear, tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.